Welcome to episode 124 of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast for May the 12th, 2009. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. On this Bike to Work Week episode of the Fredcast, the Amgen Tour of California moves to May. Anti-harassment laws in Colorado and South Carolina, Giro d'Italia news, news about Tom Bonin and Alejandro Valverde, Sunnyvale giving priority to bikes over parking, and the speed limit in a park impacts cyclists. Following the news, two fantastic interviews, first with our Bike Shop of the Month, and then answering your questions on climbing. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Fredcast. I'm really excited about this show. We've got two amazing interviews after the news, so stand by for those. You're really going to enjoy them. But first, I want to thank our sponsor, Graham Street's Cyclo Club. This is the cycling hub on the internet for everyday cyclists just like you and me. Now, I've told you a lot about Cyclo Club and the way that I use it over the last couple of weeks, but you know, last week, Graham Street was on the show offering you a free gift of a download of just one of his over 80 different video workouts that are available to you on Cyclo Club. This is the Cyclo Back in 5 workout. It's a free download, a free gift, something you can put on your iPhone or your iPod, take with you and use, and it's going to fix those lower back problems that it seems like every cyclist I talk to has. This is a core low back durability module, just one of those modules that's available to you when you become a Cyclo Club member. But this is just a free download, your free gift. Keep it forever. Give it a try. See if it works. I've tried it. I think if you use it, you're going to ride stronger, and you're going to be glad that you downloaded this workout. Download it. Try it. Ride stronger. Remember, this video is available for a limited time only, so don't delay. Go to www.thefredcast.com and download it right away. It's from Graham Street and Cyclo Club, and we thank them so much for their support of the Fredcast. Well, now it's time for the news, and topping the news this week, you may know that the Amgen Tour of California is one of my favorite events every year, and that simply is because it brings great professional road racing, stage racing here to the United States. It makes it much more accessible to American cycling fans on the West Coast. And you know, I've been following the race for a couple of years and broadcasting it or podcasting it here on the Fredcast. And we've been doing that in February. This year, there were a lot of rumors about whether or not the Amgen Tour of California would change the date in order to take advantage of better weather. Because as you'll recall, in the 2009 edition of the Amgen Tour of California, the racers had to deal with wind, rain, cold. It was really, really miserable. And there was a lot of people saying that maybe they should move the tour, trying to get better weather. Well, the announcement came down last week that indeed that's exactly what they're going to be doing for 2010. They're going to be moving the Amgen Tour of California to the month of May, May 16th through the 23rd to be exact. Now, the problem, of course, with having it during May is that it conflicts with a race we're going to talk about in just a few minutes, and that's the Giro d'Italia, one of the three grand tours every year. One of the things that made the Amgen Tour of California so spectacular and so compelling for American cycling fans was the fact that we were getting some of the best racers in the world coming to California to do this race. The question is whether or not those racers will be in California if they have to choose between the Giro d'Italia and the Tour of California. And my bet is that most of those professional racers on the European Pro Tour circuit are going to choose the Giro over the Tour of California. Now, on the plus side, absolutely, the racers should be able to see better weather, and that better weather should allow the race better access to the High Sierra for perhaps some mountaintop finishes, and that should make the race even more exciting. As for me, considering the fact that I'm sitting podcasting this from Park City, Utah, instead of podcasting it from some exotic locale in northern Italy, tells you where I will probably be next May. I'll probably be in California covering the Tour of California while I'm covering the Giro d'Italia remotely, just like I am this year. Should be interesting to see who comes to the Amgen Tour of California next year, and even more interesting to see who comes in 2011, because the stories are that in 2011, the Amgen Tour of California will have Pro Tour status. More on all of this as it develops. Good news for cyclists in Colorado, because a bill signed into law by your governor yesterday is going to make it that much safer for you out there on the road. Senate Bill 148 requires drivers to stay at least 3 feet away from cyclists while passing them. And drivers are now allowed to cross a center line to pass cyclists in situations where there's no oncoming traffic. But here's the part that hopefully will make it even safer for you out there on the road. In addition to a $110 fine for passing too closely to cyclists, there is an anti-harassment provision in the law, which makes it a Class 2 misdemeanor for anyone who throws an object at a cyclist. And violation of that law could result in a fine of between $250 and $1,000, plus a possible sentence of 3 to 12 months in jail. Now, this law takes effect August 5th, and according to a spokesman from Bicycle Colorado, quote, "It's good for everybody on the road. It brings a lot of common sense, share the road practices into law." Now, a county sheriff in Larimer County, Jim Alderden, well, he had quite a different story about the 3-foot provision. He said, quote, "The 3-foot rule is a nice touchy-feely, feel-good piece of legislation that's going to be impossible to enforce. The principle is sound. People should stay 3 feet away, but the enforcement is going to be problematic." He went on to say that he objected to the fact that while the law makes it necessary for cars to stay 3 feet away from cyclists, what it doesn't do is to require cyclists to ride inside paved shoulders when those shoulders exist. He said, quote, "If they're allowed to ride 2 abreast and they don't have to ride on the shoulder, it's going to cause conflict with the motoring public. When you have one object moving 10 miles per hour, and I don't ride 10 miles per hour very often, but okay, let's go on. When you have one object moving 10 miles per hour and another object moving 45, there's going to be conflict and potential danger, usually to the smaller of the object. That's just basic physics. When you add the frustration that comes on the part of some motorists, it could create a more dangerous situation for the bicyclist." Well, it sounds like there's one sheriff who, well, it sounds like he's trying to say he supports the law, isn't sounding like he's going to be able to enforce it, or perhaps he doesn't want to enforce it. By the way, George Hincappy tweeted yesterday that a similar law was also recently passed in South Carolina, especially about the anti-harassment provision. Good idea. I hope to see more anti-harassment laws around the country. As someone who's been shot by a pellet gun by some kids who just felt like shooting me because I was on a bike and they were in a car, I'm happy to hear that anti-harassment laws are going to be protecting cyclists against the angry, the juvenile, or the just plain stupid. Well, if you listened to last week's show, you know that I was lamenting the fact that as of that moment, the Giro d'Italia was not planned to be televised here in the United States, either by Versus or by Cycling.tv. And that was a real problem for those of us who like to watch these grand tours, especially for those of us who think that as far as cycling action and scenery and difficulty of a multi-week stage race, the Giro d'Italia eclipses the Tour de France. Well, if you listened to our latest episode of the Spokesman Cycling Roundtable podcast, or perhaps if you follow me on Twitter, you know that at the last minute, a deal was announced between organizers of the Giro d'Italia and the North American cable TV network, Universal Sports. Now, I've put a link in the show notes as well as in the Enhanced podcast to where you can find Universal Sports online. They are showing live video of every Giro d'Italia stage right there on their website, and they're televising the Giro d'Italia shortly thereafter on the cable channel for Universal Sports. So if you go to the website, you'll be able to find out where you can find your Universal Sports on your cable or satellite provider in the United States and in Canada. Now, one comment. For the first few days, Universal Sports was providing their feed in a Windows Media Player format. For those of you on Macintosh, you need to have the latest version of QuickTime and the latest version of the Flip 4 Mac plugin. However, before you go out and look to see if you have those, today Universal Sports switched from a Windows Media feed to a Flash feed. In this case, you need, no matter what platform you're on, the latest version of the Adobe Flash Player. So go out and get that. I will admit that a lot of folks had problems with the feed the first few days. It would not, for some reason, play for many people in the Firefox web browser, although it was working in Internet Explorer and in Safari, both on Mac and PC. Today, however, I was having a problem with the Flash Player, both on Firefox and on Safari, although lots of folks said that if you simply reloaded the page and were patient, it would come up and play. Hopefully, they'll be improving the experience over the next couple of days so that we can watch the rest of the Giro d'Italia live while we're at work or at home, but I'm glad to see that we were finally able to get live coverage of the Giro d'Italia here in the United States and Canada. Well, if you haven't had the opportunity to watch the Giro, and perhaps you haven't had the opportunity to follow the news, the Giro has been exciting so far in its first four stages. The first stage was a team time trial that took place in Venice, Italy. Gorgeous scenery and a great race course, with first place going to Team Colombia in 21 minutes and 50 seconds. Second place going to Team Garmin Chipotle, just 6 seconds back. And third going to Lance Armstrong and Levi Leipheimer's Team Astana, 13 seconds back. After that great team time trial performance, the top seven in the general classification were all from Team Colombia, with the Maglia Rosa, or the pink leader's jersey in the Giro d'Italia, going to Mark Cavendish from Britain. The second stage of this year's Giro d'Italia was a 156-kilometer route from Gesolo to Trieste. And once again, the coverage just made it look gorgeous there in northern Italy during this second stage of the event. And for much of the day, all eyes were on ISD's Leonardo Scarzelli, who was on a solo breakaway, and he began that just 9 kilometers into the race. He was eventually reeled in on those finishing circuits in Trieste. And just as it looked like the fastest man in the world, Mark Cavendish, was getting an amazing lead out from one of his teammates, well, Alessandro Petacchi from Team LPR in Italy went right past him and beat Cavendish by a bike length. After the end of the stage, Petacchi said, quote, "It's been 3 days that I've been thinking how to beat Cavendish, and I did it just how I imagined." Now, despite the fact that Petacchi did take first place in the stage, second place going to Cavendish, and third going to Ben Swift from Team Katusha, Cavendish kept the Maglia Rosa after 4 hours, 4 minutes, and 43 seconds in the saddle overall. Second place also from Team Colombia, Mark Renshaw, and third still, Michael Rogers, also from Team Colombia. Stage 3, going from Grado to Valdobbiadene in Italy, was 198 kilometers, and while it was led for much of the day by a small group, which was finally caught after 163 kilometers, it was once again Alessandro Petacchi who ruled the day, and he was able to do so when a crash occurred within about 10 kilometers of the finish line that split the peloton, leaving many riders standing still until the road was cleared. By that point, Petacchi had taken advantage and was able to sprint away from the chasing Tyler Farah of Team Garmin. Petacchi taking it in 4 hours, 45 minutes, and 27 seconds. Second place on the day going to Tyler Farah, and third going to Francesco Gavazzi from Team Lampre. At the end of the day, in the Maglia Rosa, was Alessandro Petacchi, 8 hours, 50 minutes, and 6 seconds in the saddle for the entire Giro so far. Garmin's Tyler Farah was sitting in second place in the GC, 8 seconds back. Michael Rogers from Team Colombia, 18 seconds in third place. At the same time, in fourth, also from Team Colombia, Thomas Lokvist. And in fifth place, a newcomer to the world of professional cycling from Team Astana, 31 seconds back, a young man by the name of Lance Armstrong. One sad note for Garmin Slipstream rider, American Christian Vandeveld. He had a hard fall in stage 3 yesterday, going down and breaking 2 ribs and also having some contusions on his back. Took him out of the stage and out of the Giro d'Italia. However, all indications are that Vandeveld should be recovered for the Tour de France in July. The Giro headed into the mountains of the Dolomite region today, and today's stage was won by Danilo De Luca. De Luca, having been born in the province of Pescara, dedicated this win to the victims of last year's earthquake in Abruzzo, saying, quote, "Today I wanted to win for my land, the Abruzzo. I'm delighted to have achieved that." For his part, Lance Armstrong lost 15 seconds to the Italians and the other race leaders in the stage today, just seeming to run a little bit short out of gas toward the end of the stage. Apparently, the Italians are trying to take as much out of Armstrong as possible before the individual time trials later in the race. De Luca saying, quote, "We're trying to cut him out completely. It's tough, but we're going to try again tomorrow. It's going to be a very competitive Giro. This first week is very important for me because the time trial doesn't suit me." Officially, De Luca taking first place in today's stage. At the same time, second place Stefano Garzelli from the Acqua e Sapone team. Third place to Franco Pellizzotti from Team Liquigas. Fourth, Mauricio Soler from Team Barlow World, who looked like he was going to win today's stage, but was swept up by the rest of the group just shy of the finish line. Fifth place going to Gilberto Simoni from Team Dicky Giovanni. In the overall general classification, at the end of four stages of the 2009 Giro d'Italia, in the Maglia Rosa now is Thomas Lokvist from Team Colombia after 13 hours, 5 minutes, and 28 seconds. In second place, today's stage winner Danilo De Luca from Team LPR. He's just 2 seconds back. In third, Michael Rogers from Team Colombia, 6 seconds behind Lokvist. In fourth, Yaroslav Popovic from Team Astana, 26 seconds back. And in fifth place, at the same time as his Astana teammate, Levi Leipheimer from the United States. One more note from the Giro d'Italia, and actually this is a note from the 2008 Giro d'Italia, and that's because drug samples from last year's Giro d'Italia have now been sent by Italian police and prosecutors to the French lab, the infamous French lab, Châtenay-Malabry, so that they can be tested for SARA, the new form of EPO that Ricardo Rico was caught for at the 2008 Tour de France. Apparently, a cyclist named Emanuele Sella tested positive in July for SARA in an out-of-competition drug test, and at that time named other riders who used the substance during last year's Giro. As a result, Padua prosecutor Benedetto Roberti requested that the samples be retested in December, and this was just reported Saturday, just ahead of the start of this year's Giro. If anything comes out of those tests, we'll be sure to let you know right here on the Fredcast. And finally, one last note from this year's Giro, and this is about Lance Armstrong and Levi Leipheimer's Team Astana. As you may know, Astana, the team, gets most of its financial support from a state holding company in Kazakhstan, as well as from the Kazakh National Airline. Well, recently, the Kazakh National Airline pulled out of sponsorship, and apparently this holding company is also having financial problems due to the world financial crisis. There were stories a few weeks ago that Team Astana was having trouble making their payroll. Well, now the International Cycling Union, the UCI, has given Team Astana until May 31st to get their financial house in order, or, according to Johan Bruneel, quote, "If it's not taken care of by then, the team will be suspended." He went on to say, "At least we're going to be able to finish the Giro d'Italia." There are all sorts of rumors out there that Lance Armstrong is considering putting his money into the team, and also that Johan Bruneel might have to take over from this Kazakh state holding company so that Team Astana can continue, hold on to their UCI Pro Tour license, and continue to participate in races throughout 2009. However, the BBC quotes Lance Armstrong as saying that the team requires as much as $8 million to race for the rest of the year. So I think in this tough financial climate, they may have a hard time finding sponsorship. However, they do have one of the best lineups in the world of professional cycling, including one of the most famous names in sport next to people like Tiger and Kobe and Beckham. So I think that there's every opportunity that if anybody's going to do it, it's going to be Team Astana. We'll have more on this too as it develops. Well, as much as we dislike talking about doping here on the show, there are two huge doping stories in the world of professional cycling this week. The first concerning former world champion and Quickstep team member Tom Bonin. Bonin, it was revealed failed yet another out-of-competition doping test, yet again for cocaine, and he has been suspended, although not fired, by his Quickstep team. You may recall that Bonin was withdrawn from the 2008 Tour de France due to an out-of-competition test for cocaine as well. He missed that one, and it looks fairly certain that he probably will miss this year's Tour de France as well due to this positive test. You also may recall that in February, a Belgian court found Bonin guilty of cocaine use, but decided not to give him any criminal sanctions, thereby saving him, at that point, from sanctions in the world of professional cycling. What's important to understand is that failing an out-of-competition test for cocaine use is not officially against UCI rules. However, yesterday, the UCI said, quote, "The behavior of Tom Bonin, even though it does not constitute a violation of the anti-doping rules, can be considered unacceptable and liable to harm the image, reputation, or interests of cycling or the UCI." They went on to say this infringement is punishable by a suspension of 1 to 6 months. Bonin was quoted as saying that his use of cocaine on this particular occasion was brought on by an alcohol problem and that he is going to be getting treatment. And it seems like that's exactly what he needs. Obviously, he's not using cocaine or alcohol for that matter as a performance-enhancing drug. Instead, it's more perhaps of either a recreational or simply a drug problem that he has. And if he's going to go to rehab, we wish him all the luck in the world and hope that the treatment will help him and bring him back to the world of professional cycling healthier, stronger, and better than he was. Meanwhile, Spanish cyclist and Casta Parña member Alejandro Valverde has been banned from racing in Italy for 2 years by the anti-doping panel of the Italian Olympic Committee, or CONI. Now, you may be wondering, why is it that the Italian Olympic Committee would be ruling against a Spanish cyclist and banning him from racing in Italy? Well, the answer is simple, and once again, it goes back to, here it comes, folks, Operation Puerto. You'll recall that there were these allegations about a certain Dr. Eufemiano Fuentes, who was working with a number of professional athletes, many of them cyclists, on doping to increase their athletic performance. And it was alleged that Alejandro Valverde was included in that doping scheme. Well, Italian prosecutors asked Spanish authorities for samples from some of the bags of blood that were found in the lab of Eufemiano Fuentes, including one particular bag in which it was believed there was the blood of Alejandro Valverde. When the Tour de France came through Italy last year, Alejandro Valverde was specifically targeted by Italian prosecutors. They took samples of his blood. They matched the DNA to the blood found in one of the bags from Dr. Eufemiano Fuentes, and they used that DNA match as evidence against him in this tribunal in Rome. By the way, Valverde was not present at the tribunal. While this ban currently only has effect in Italy, it could affect Valverde's chances of racing in this year's Tour de France. And the reason is that one of the stages of the Tour de France does go through Italy, and therefore Italian prosecutors could literally, and police could literally be waiting at the border as Valverde raced across. Now, the Tour de France organizers do have the option of altering that stage so that it stays within France, just as the Giro d'Italia organizers altered one of the stages of this year's Giro d'Italia to keep it out of France, just in case Lance Armstrong had problems there due to that whole Showergate situation. But at this point, it looks doubtful that Alejandro Valverde will be racing in this year's Tour de France, and there is even the slightest possibility that the UCI could extend this ban internationally. We'll see what happens over the days and weeks to come. Here's some good news for those of you who are in or near the Northern California town of Sunnyvale. Bike lanes and other forms of transportation are now going to get preference when Sunnyvale allocates street space in the future. And this is according to a new policy in the city's general plan. Now, this policy was recently unanimously approved by the Sunnyvale City Council, and it requires that all modes of transportation, cars, bikes, and pedestrians have safe access to city streets. And it also gives on-street parking a lesser priority than the safety of bikes and pedestrians. And that means that they will give priority to building bike lanes over building areas for the parking of motor vehicles. Great news for those of you that are in and around Sunnyvale. And if you ever get a chance to see a Sunnyvale City Council member, make sure you give them a thank you. Meanwhile, halfway across the country in Peoria, Illinois, authorities are lowering the speed limit in a park there called Washington Park. And they say that this new speed limit will apply not only to cars, but also to bicycles. Now, right now, the speed limit in Washington Park is 20 miles per hour, but it's going down to 15 miles per hour at the end of May. Police Captain Jonathan Davis says that the average speed of a bike going through Washington Park right now is 18 to 21 miles per hour, and therefore, as a result, cyclists could be issued warnings or even citations depending upon the seriousness of the offense. So for those of you in Peoria, Illinois, and you're going to hear we're going to be talking to a bike shop in Illinois in a few minutes, please lower your speed as you go through Washington Park. You don't need to get a speeding ticket on your bike. And finally, since we have entered Grand Tour season, and as somebody on Twitter said earlier, you know it's Grand Tour season when Jens Voigt is off on a solo breakaway, which is exactly what happened in today's stage of the Giro d'Italia. Because it is Grand Tour season, the American television network Versus and the internet site MapMyRide.com have teamed up to present a new contest aimed at getting more cyclists involved in the three great cycling races around the world. Of course, the three Grand Tours, the Giro d'Italia, the Tour de France, and the Vuelta a España. Starting with the Giro d'Italia this week, MapMyRide.com and Versus have launched the Grand Tours Challenge. For each of the Grand Tours, Versus and MapMyRide.com have created interactive competitions allowing cyclists to get on their bikes and compete virtually against actual race competitors and other cyclists around the world. According to Robin Thurston, the CEO of MapMyFitness, quote, combining our world-class online fitness technology with the television home of cycling in the U.S. will allow us to engage the average cyclist like never before. The goal here is to encourage more people to get off the couch and ride by making them feel they're right there in the peloton. Now, for instance, in the Giro, the Giro Challenge consists of three separate challenges: a team distance challenge, a King of the Mountains jersey challenge, and a Cycling Pros versus, get it, Cycling Pros versus Cycling Joes challenge. Prizes are going to be awarded in 82 separate competitions over the duration of the race, and participants will provide their ride data to MapMyRide.com via GPS downloads. MapMyRide.com will offer free downloads of GPS tracking software for 3G iPhone and BlackBerry cell phone users. According to Neil Scarborough, VP of Digital Media for Versus, quote, we're very pleased to partner with MapMyRide.com on this challenge. As the home of professional cycling in the U.S., we not only offer the most complete coverage of the sport, but also want to ensure that our viewers get access to the latest online features that will connect them closer with cycling. Now, I've put links in the show notes as well as in the enhanced version of the podcast so you can check out the challenge. It sounds like a lot of fun. If you feel like it's too late to get involved in the Giro Challenge, don't worry. The Tour de France Challenge and the Vuelta a España Challenge are still to come. My only objection to the story and the press release that they put out is the fact that, well, at least for the Giro d'Italia, Versus isn't the home of cycling on television in North America. Nevertheless, for most parts of the year, they certainly are, so we'll give them those props. Sounds like a great thing. If any of you participate, if you do well in it, let me know. I would love to highlight you here on the Fredcast. And with that story, this will end the news for this episode of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast. Now, before we get to the features tonight, I've got two great interviews that I know I keep teasing, but they're really fantastic, so stay tuned. Before we get to that, I just want to remind you, since we're talking about the Grand Tours and some of these amazing cycling locations in Europe, I want to remind you about our upcoming Fredcast tour to the French Alps. We're calling it the Chasseurs de Col 2009, and that stands for the Coal Seekers. This is going to be really a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It takes place September 5th through the 12th, and yes, we do have just a few spots available. Imagine climbing up to 12 of the French Alps' most famous cols, plus a few that maybe you haven't heard of, but that I think you're really going to find spectacular, not only for their scenery, but also for the cycling. Imagine climbing the Col de la Colombière, the Col de la Forclaz, Col de la Madeleine, Col du Télégraphe, my favorite, Col du Galibier, and of course, who can forget climbing the 21 switchbacks of the Alpe d'Huez. This tour is going to be literally the memory of a lifetime and something you will never forget. And I would really love to have you join me on this trip. Remember, it's September 5th through the 12th. I've put links in the show notes on the blog page and also in the enhanced podcast. But please, the trip is going to fill up fast. We do have a few spots left. Don't miss out. Mark your calendar September 5th through the 12th and sign up today for the Chasseur de Col 2009. I can't wait to ride with you in the French Alps. Go to vivatravels.com for more info. That's Viva, V-I-V-A, travels.com. Can't wait to see you in September in the French Alps. You know, a little over a month ago, I talked about the fact that we wanted to add a new feature to the Fredcast. And that new feature was to allow you to nominate your favorite independent bike shop to become the Fredcast Bike Shop of the Month. I had a great time looking through all of the nominations we've received. And by the way, please continue to send your nominations. There's a link in the show notes to where you can send those because this is absolutely going to be a regular feature. I really enjoyed the interview you're about to hear from somebody who is obviously passionate about what he does. It comes through his voice, it comes through on their website, and it comes through on the email that we got from a listener nominating Spokes Bikes of Naperville and Wheaton, Illinois. Here's my interview with the owner, Raouf Radi. I can't wait till the next time I'm in Chicago because I want to go visit Spokes Bikes. I hope you enjoy this interview. Today, I am pleased to be talking to Raouf Radi. Raouf is the owner of Spokes Bikes in Wheaton, Illinois. Welcome to the Fredcast.
Well, thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Now, you are our inaugural Bike Shop of the Month here on the Fredcast, and one of our listeners, Rob, nominated you because he said some amazing things about your shop. Now, first of all, where's Wheaton, Illinois? I guess that's somewhere near Chicago, right?
We are 20 miles west of Chicago.
So you've got a lot of customers who come in, who perhaps work in the city, live out in Wheaton, and they come in to see you for all of their cycling needs, right?
That's correct, yeah.
How long have you been in business?
25 years.
And what got you interested in being a bicycle dealer?
My background, I'm a mechanical engineer. I did that for 15 years. But prior to that, I used to race on a professionally. And you know how it is. It's in your blood and you can't get rid of it. And so I went back to my passion. And I work very hard. I work 6-7 days a week, but I truly enjoy it.
And when you started, the business was very different than it is today. Tell me, what kind of brands did you start with? And what was cycling like then versus the way it is today?
You know, back then, the technology, you know, it's amazing how the technology advanced the last 10 years. The bikes back then were heavy. I mean, a lightweight bike was 21, 22 pounds. And now you can build a bike for 14 pounds, which is incredible. A big brand back then was like a Miata, and they were famous for their steel bikes, and that was like a big thing back then.
Now, when you started the business, what percentage of bikes were you selling that were road bikes? What percentage were mountain bikes? Was that different then?
You know, back then we didn't have mountain bikes. Mm. You know, it was mostly like street bikes, road bikes, kind of a thing. And then now the selection have evolved, and you get like 15 different kinds of bikes, from triathlon-specific bike to road bike to comfort bike to hybrid bikes to road sport bikes to fixed gear bikes. I mean, it's just incredible what, you know, cyclocross bikes, tri-cross bikes.
Wow. Now, what do you focus on there at Spokes Bikes? Is there one genre that is most important to you and your customers?
you know, we try to appeal to a wide segment of the population. We try, our philosophy is to promote cycling. We believe it's good for the environment, it's good for people's health and mental being. So we like, you know, we try to encourage people to get into the sport. And once they do, they can understand and appreciate good bikes. But our focus is on all kinds of bikes, but we are known for our high-end road bikes.
So when you say high-end road bikes, give me an idea of the brands that you sell.
We sell like Specialized, which is probably the most innovative brand now in the market. And they have passion for the sport. They do a lot of research and development. All the money they make goes back into the business to produce better products. We do Giant, which is a huge company. It's like the largest company in the world, actually, Giant. Last year, they did $1 billion in sales of bicycles. And then we do other niche brands, you know, European brands like Pinarello's, Italian brand, and Colnago's. We do Masi, which is also Italian. So we try to have a little bit for everybody.
Well, I ride a Colnago, so I love talking to dealers.
You know what I'm talking about. Yeah.
I do. So what about group rides and clubs? Do you sponsor a club? Do you do any group rides? Anything that you want to tell people about that you do every week?
Yeah, our philosophy is, you know, anybody can sell you a bike, but what we really emphasize on that you should use your bike. Mm. So we take our time in terms of selecting the right product for the person. Yeah, a lot of people do their research and homework and stuff like that, but we are the experts. So when they come to us, you know, our biggest challenge is to see what the potential of the customer is. And you don't want to undersell them or oversell them, you know. A person has potential to ride a lot, and you sell them a bike because of, you know, lower price point. They go out, they ride it, they don't enjoy it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So basically you have to figure out what their potential is, what, you know, for the future, and try to sell them the right product. So they don't outgrow the bike, and you don't want to sell them too much of a bike if it's a casual rider. So that's our biggest challenge. So once we sell them the bike, we take the time to fit them on the bike, because as you know, an owner of a Colnago, you know, the bike, a centimeter here and there makes a huge difference for comfort and performance. So we select the bike for them, we fit them properly on the bike, and then we have group rides to encourage them to go out and ride their bike. Because if you ride by yourself, it's kind of intimidating. We live in an urban area, and a lot of people are intimidated to be on the streets with cars and stuff like that. But if you go in a big group, we teach them the riding ethics and the safety in a group, and, you know, how to rotate, how to draft, how to do all that stuff. So they enjoy it more. And then they get motivated more when they ride their bike.
So for people who are in the area, if they wanted to come out and join some of your group rides, when do you do your group rides?
We do like four rides a week.
Mm-hmm.
We do three rides, road rides on the streets. And we do those on Tuesday and Thursday nights at 6 p.m. And we go now about 30 miles. And when we have more daylight, we'll be going 35 to 40 miles. And it's a no-drop ride, which means, you know, nobody gets left behind.
Right.
Yeah, so everybody enjoys it. And then on Saturday, we do longer rides. We start at 9 in the morning. And people can do 20-mile loop, 35-mile loop, or they can do a 60-mile loop.
Now, our listener told us that you've also got a setup in your shop for indoor training. Tell me about that.
Yeah, this is really a neat thing because, as you know, we live in a cold climate here.
Yeah.
So comes November, I mean, the weather turns really nasty, and this year we had really bad winter, I mean, with snow and ice and everything. So what we do, we set up 8 computerized trainers, and so you bring in your own bike. You know, unlike spinning when you go to the health club where you're riding a bike that is totally different geometry than your bike, and you're using different muscles and everything. So this one, you bring in your own bike, we put on a trainer, and all 8 trainers are connected together with a computer program. And we select a course, and there's a profile of the course on a screen in front of you. So you can see yourself when you go uphill or downhill, okay? And people can draft each other. So, like, if you're in front of me 6 to 16 feet and it gives you that error, my bike goes in a draft mode and I'm exerting 20% less effort depending on the speed. It can be more at a higher speed. And so the computer sends a signal to the trainer, and if you're going uphill, it gets tighter and you have to shift gears. It simulates riding outside, like, exactly, you know?
Yeah.
And it makes it fun because you get motivated when you ride with other people. You use your own bike, so you continue to use the same muscles you use outside. And it's just, you know, they are normally an hour to an hour and a half sessions. And I tell you, we're busy all winter with that.
I believe it. That's really, now, what do you use, CompuTrainers?
Yeah, we use CompuTrainers. And I couldn't believe, like, this spring when we started riding outside, how everybody's in great shape because of that. Normally it takes a while for people to get in shape.
Right.
But everybody that used it was just in awesome shape.
Good point. Yeah. Now, yeah. Rob also told us that you do some international travel with your customers. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we do, you know, an average 2 to 3 trips a year. And, you know, I like to travel with my bike. And this way you experience other cultures and you see things, you know, firsthand. And so I used to do that by myself. And a few people asked me to if they can join. I was like, okay, we've been doing that for 20 years. So I'll take maximum of 20 people at a time, and we arrange all the, we own a travel agency also.
Mm-hmm.
So they arrange all the travel for us. We don't mark it up, so it's very economical. And this way you travel with people you know instead of going with strangers, you know. And it's a lot of fun. And we just, like last trip we did was in Portugal. And I don't like to pack and unpack, you know how it is.
Yeah.
It ruins the trip, basically. And so what we did, we flew to Lisbon, spent 2 days there doing a tourist stuff. Then after that, we went to Porto, and we hopped in a riverboat cruise. And the riverboat cruise accommodates like 80 people. And then we put our luggage, everything, that was our floating hotel.
Mm.
And so the riverboat went from Porto all the way to Spain on the river. And so they'll go, I mean, the first day was 70 miles and was just phenomenal, the scenery and everything else. So they would sail in the morning and we would ride our bikes all day and meet them when they dock at night or whatever. And so we have the maps and we just go from point A to point B and meet them there and, you know, go on the boat, take a shower, have dinner and sleep on the boat. And, you know, when the boat goes to the next port, we just ride our bikes and meet them there. So that was a great trip.
I'm incredibly jealous. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was really neat.
Yeah.
And we did the one before that, we did Provence in France.
Mm.
So that was very awesome too.
Wow. Now, I've also heard, besides being, you know, our bike shop of the month, I've also heard that in 2009, you were in the Bicycle Retailer Top 100. Is that correct?
Yes, we were selected as top 100 dealer in the country, and there were like, I think, 6,000 bike shops. So that was an honor. I mean, we work hard to accomplish that.
So tell me, before we go, because, I mean, you've told us about all the brands you have and the things you do for your customers and the travel and the training and all of that. In your opinion, because, I mean, you're in a dense metropolitan area where there's, let's face it, a lot of bike shops and a lot of competition. What is it, if you were just to encapsulate, what is it that makes your shop, Spokes Bikes, what makes Spokes Bikes the best?
We really care. We care about our customers. We work so hard to have everybody come in and leave with a very positive experience. And when people come to a bike shop, they come in with, you know, good expectation because it's a fun sport. So we try to make dealing with us a fun, stress-free experience. So basically when they buy a bike from us, we tell them anybody can sell you a bike, but this is the beginning of a good relationship. So any problem with the bike, we... Very seldom a customer leave their bike overnight here if they have any problem.
Mm-hmm.
We always take care of it the same day because we all ride bikes and we know how it is to be without your bike. So we take care of people. We take care of our customers, and most of the customers become like friends. I mean, some customers come in just hang out in the shop for an hour, so just talking to us and stuff like that.
Nice.
So this is really the key. It's just you treat people like you want to be treated. You know, we treat them with respect. We take care of their cycling needs, and people appreciate that.
Well, Rob must have appreciated it because he nominated you. What's interesting is as we've been talking, I've heard the door open, I've heard the phone ring, so you must be doing well. That's really good. Tell everybody how they can find you, where you're located, where you are on the web, and if they want to call you, how they can do that.
Our phone number is 630-690-2050. And we have two stores. Our main store, the one you called me at, is in Wheaton, Illinois. And we are at 69 Doneda East Shopping Center, and that is on the corner of Naperville Road and Butterfield Road. We're about half an hour from downtown Chicago and the western suburbs. Well, our other store is in Naperville, and it's in Hawthorne Square, which is about a mile south of 75th Street and Washington Street. And we are open 7 days a week, and we love people to stop by and just look at what we have. Our shop is really high tech. People come in from Europe, from everywhere. We are known for bike fitting. And again, bike fitting is a science. It's not like you read a book or read a computer program and you measure a person and you fit them on a bike. It comes with experience. We do about 500 fittings a year, so that's a lot of knowledge there. And we get people to come from Indiana, Wisconsin, just for our bike fitting.
Well, I'll tell you what, the next time I'm in the Chicago area, I'm going to stop in and see you. But in the meantime, if people want to look you up on the web, you're at spokesbikes.com. Is that right?
That's correct.
Very good. Raouf, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for spending a little bit of time with us today here on the Fredcast.
Thank you so much, and you have a wonderful day.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I enjoyed doing it. Speaking with Raouf was really a great pleasure for me. And we are still looking for more nominations for more bike shops of the month. We'll have another one coming up in June. Make sure that you get your nominations in. And don't forget to visit spokesbikes.com for more information on Spokes Bikes. Now, for those of you who follow my Twitter feed at twitter.com/Fredcast, you may know that last week I asked a question, got some great responses from you. And the question was this: if you have questions or concerns about climbing on your bike, I asked you to send me those via Twitter, and I got some great questions. Now, you know that Cyclo Club is a sponsor of the Fredcast, but part of the sponsorship agreement was that Graham would come on the show and he would answer your questions and concerns, really having nothing to do with trying to advertise his services, but just provide a service to you so that you could learn more and become a better cyclist. So I had a chance to sit down via Skype with Graham Street last week and asked him your questions about climbing. I know you're going to get a lot out of this interview. So here's my interview with Graham Street on cycling climbing. Oh, and by the way, one of the things you'll notice is that we had so many questions, we actually had to turn this into a two-parter. So this is part one of my interview with Graham Street on climbing. Hope you enjoy it. Welcome back, Graham Street, to the Fredcast. How's it going today, Graham?
Good, man. It's great to be here again. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Hey, today we're doing something different. Instead of me interviewing Graham, we've asked a number of listeners to provide us with questions. The most pressing topics on their mind when it comes to climbing. So I've got a list of questions here, Graham, and if you don't mind, I'm going to ask them. I got a lot of questions from the listeners, actually on Twitter. So let's just get started right here. Graham, which climbing theory is truly the fastest, high gear or high cadence, or does it depend on the rider?
It's an excellent question. It's one that I get a lot, and one that I've always asked myself a lot as well. I believe, without doubt, that a good rider should have both abilities, meaning that both questions are correct, both answers are correct. Most riders will tend to favor higher gear, lower cadence climbing. And the reason for that is that a lot of us everyday cyclists don't have the aerobic capacity, or more importantly, the neuromuscular efficiency to climb with faster cadences. And what I mean by that is it's not easy. If you try to go out and climb, you know, a 3 or 4 minute climb, and if your normal climbing cadence is 80 RPM and you want to try to raise it to 100, a lot of people are going to tap out quick because their aerobic system and their neuromuscular system just can't handle it. So what we want to teach, what we spend a lot of time with our customers and members with, is helping them practice both ends of the spectrum. So we use things like super spin techniques, which basically forces you to use what you want to call it climbing intervals, or you want to call it chunking, or variety of both. Remember, I talked about chunking on our last episode. We are helping the individual work with neuromuscular efficiency to bring the cadence above where they feel comfortable. So again, if they feel comfortable at 80 at their natural rhythm, we force them to practice at 90, 95, 100. Even if they're hurting during those practice sessions, what we're hoping for is to lay some kind of framework both aerobically and with their neuromuscular efficiency, so when they go back to their natural climbing cadence, they might be able to go from 80 to 82 or 85. And then we practice the other end of the spectrum, too, and we'll practice what's called overpowering. So we'll shift them into a gear that's much harder than they can handle for the slope involved or for the climb involved. They're kind of what I would call mashing it out. And you and I both, you know what that means? Or you ever mashed it out going up a hill?
I did the ops last year. I did a lot of mashing.
Yeah. And, you know, mashing has its pros and cons. For a lot of people, when you're using your muscular strength to go up a hill, you might favor better. The problem is that you're going to get that muscular breakdown. So in the short term, it's a good solution. In the long term, especially for our over 40 riders, it can cause a lot of problems, whether it's a knee problem, whether it's muscular breakdown, catabolism. So what we try to do is work with the higher gear, lower cadence climbs, not because we want you to climb in a mashing fashion, but because we want you to build the strength that's necessary. So again, when you go back to your natural rhythm, you see improvement. You see, when you want to climb faster, there's really just one key secret. You want to improve your strength and then match that with the ability to spin faster. So if you can spin 5 or 8 RPM faster, okay, and in the same gear that you were currently using, mashing, you're going to go, what, half mile per hour faster up the hill, maybe faster than that? It's amazing. I think people they see it as such extremes. I'm either quote unquote a fast spinner up the hill, or I'm a masher. I say neither. When I pick climbs that I'm doing, I'll use a variety of different tactics. I tend to favor higher spin cadences, but that's only relative to myself. What I recommend for everyone that's listening is to practice. So find like maybe a 3 minute climb in your local area. Okay, it's a great 3 minutes is about the maximum you want to do, because anything longer, it's just going to tap you out too quickly to do repeats on. Up, you know, the first time up the hill, try doing a super spin technique. So if you're comfortable at 80, shift to a gear that forces you to 90 RPM and stay at that 90 all the way to the top. Monitor your power, monitor your heart rate, whatever you want to do. You know, clock it from point A to point B. Turn around, come back down, take about a 5 minute break, go back up again, except this time shift to a gear that's harder and force yourself to maybe 60 or 70 RPM. Get to the top, see what your time was, your heart rate, so on and so forth. Then come down, and then here's the coup de grace. You're going to go up one more time and go at what I would call your natural climbing rhythm, meaning that don't think about it. Just climb the way you feel like you want to climb, shifting gears repetitively, whatever you want to do. Then match the comparisons. Where did you feel more comfortable? Where did you have more energy at the top? Were you huffing and puffing with, you know, the circuit one, and you just couldn't handle that high of a spin? Were you doing better with the gear mashing, but your legs were kind of tapped out at the top? Those are the questions you have to ask yourself, and then you need to practice both ends of the spectrum. And we have, I don't know how many different workouts that we use and practice with that in the club, but that's where we're headed for. So when you get back to the hills, you have your natural rhythm with plus five faster, and that's going to make a discernible difference.
Now that sort of dovetails into the next question that we got from a listener. And the listener says, when I climb, I'm almost exhausted when I crest. My legs feel fine, but my energy is nearly completely gone. If I gear too low, the cadence kills me. And if too high, then I make no progress. He then says he's got a crit coming up, and it starts with a 100-foot climb right out of the box. Yep. With about 100 feet to recover before another slow, steady one. The question is, how should I handle gearing for the start of this so I have something left after the first few laps?
Right. This is a technique we work on in our climbing boot camp that's we call rollovers. Some people call it cresting. It's actually kind of like a little known tip and secret of a lot of really high-end and pro-level cyclists. And there's a lot of different ways that we can practice it. But the bottom line is that the average everyday cyclist, when they know the climb is coming, they tend to either A, you know, position themselves incorrectly going into the climb, B, they don't gear correctly, meaning that they're not in the right gear at the right time as they hit the base of the climb, meaning they're exerting too much energy too quick, and by the time they hit the top, there's nothing left. And there's not a person that's listening to this right now that has not done that before. I've done it, I don't know how many times, where you get all charged up, you see the base of the climb, and you hit it just too hard too quick. And your hope is that, well, if I get to the climb first, then I'll be first to the top.
Mm-hmm.
My friends, 9 times out of 10, unless you've got the energy or you're riding with riders that are just much weaker than you, that's typically not going to happen. So he brings up a really interesting topic and one that I want to point out just real quick. He says, I get to the top and my legs feel fine, but my energy is nearly completely gone. What that tells me right away is that muscularly he's got the strength to get up there. Where he's weak is he's not practicing the super spin techniques, as I was saying in the last question, about getting his aerobic and neuromuscular system to catch up to his leg strength. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And does that mean that actually what he needs, besides the super spin techniques going up the hill, I mean, really he needs more flatland training. He needs more interval training in order to get his aerobic system going.
Yes and no. You know, he wants to really be using super spin techniques once or twice a week to basically begin to build his aerobic and neuromuscular capacity so he can maintain the same climbing speed. And when he hits the top and he shifts into a harder gear, he's got plenty of aerobic energy left to fuel now his strength, which is his leg strength, which again is very common. Typically, when someone says, I have a problem climbing, I ask them a direct question right away. When you get to the top of the hill, which part hurts the most? Are your legs kicked out and there's no energy left in your legs? Or are you huffing and puffing so bad you can't recoup?
Right.
If it's the muscular part, that's easy. We just start working on the core strength, the off-the-bike, you know, cyclocore trainer or whatever it is I prescribe for him. If it's the aerobic thing, then typically it needs to be on the bike. And typically my solution, and it is one of my secrets, is definitely the super spin technique work. And day one of our climbing camp, we drill the heck out of our members with super spin techniques, and 90% of them really, really struggle with day one. And the reason why is that a lot of people just don't go out purposely and practice intervals or chunks with super spins, and there's a reason why.
Because they hurt.
Well, they hurt, and here's the other thing. What they'll do is we'll say, I want you to go out and practice super spinning and pick a hill, maybe, I don't know, 5%, 6%, that you're usually maybe in your, you know, your small ring and the, you know, 15 in the back. We want you to granny gear it. So go to the absolute, you know, easiest gear you can possibly go to. Well, Graham, it's making me spin like 110 miles an hour and I'm going 2 miles per hour slower. As a result, that can't be good. I'm like, the objective is not to climb faster during the super spin practice. The objective is to challenge your neuromuscular and aerobic capacity. So when you go back to the harder gear, you're spinning with more power and more leg speed. And I'm like, oh, now I get it. And that is really where we make the discernible change. Most people, when they practice, aren't willing to practice going slower.
Right.
They think that everything has to be hard and everything has to be going faster. I'm like, no. For super spins, expect to feel like you're almost going to fall over if you're going so slow. But it's going to be challenging the heck out of you. And then they practice it, and within literally, here's the beauty part about super spinning. Just one day of our boot camp, day one, by day two, you already feel a discernible change. Discernible. And the reason why is that we've addressed a neuromuscular issue that most cyclists just don't do. They're bouncing, they're hopping in the saddle, and they haven't worked on the core strength, and then by day two, it's totally changed. And once you add the strength back on top of that, again, you're spinning now 5 RPM faster with the same or more strength. Guess what? You're going to climb faster. It's just that simple.
You know, you mentioned something a few minutes ago, and I want to pick up on it really briefly. It's not one of our listeners' questions, but you mentioned when you get to the base of the climb, being in the proper gear. And what's funny is I remember, and I'm pretty sure it was an interview with George Hincappy, and they asked him, what's one of the big mistakes people make when they get to the hills? And he says, not being in the right gear at the base. Can you address that real quickly?
Yeah, we do what's called rollover techniques or build-in techniques. So I'd rather have the everyday cyclist hit the base of the hill in a faster spin meaning raise your spin cadence about 10 RPM or so above your normal, you know, flat land or rolling pace. So if you are normally pedaling at 85 RPM, as you approach the climb, shift into an easier gear that brings you to 95 RPM, spin into the base of the hill, maintain that. As the slope begins to increase or begins to kick, continue to shift to an easier gear or lift your pace. But as you lift your pace in the same gear, your heart rate is obviously going to begin to go up. So you need to be monitoring that. And if you've practiced, again, this is where it really is the secret. You need to be practicing in your practice sessions, in your training. So you hit your weekend group ride or your century or your big climbing event or whatever, you're confident in your ability. But you begin to build your pace as you lift towards the top of the hill. And here's another quick tip that I want to share with everyone. I learned a process called sag climbing. And sag climbing is actually a pro tip that I learned from Josh. He's, you know, he works for me as my VP. And he just finished Tour de Gila, racing with Lance and everyone else over there. And he was doing sag climbing all the time. What is it? Basically, sag climbing is positioning yourself towards the front as you know a hill is approaching. So it does take some prior knowledge of where you're riding. What you're hoping for is when you hit the base of the hill, use the tactics that I just said as far as the gearing, and then allow yourself the ego to let go and allow yourself to begin to ride your pace as the stronger climbers begin to pass you. As long as you allow them to pass you and you what's called sag them, meaning it's like moving into their draft going up the hill, you don't need to be the first to the top of the hill. If there's still 50 more miles to go and you get to the top of the hill and your energy feels good, you can do what's called rolling over. So you're building your pace, building your pace, building your pace. You hit the top and you've got energy left over. And if you've ever ridden with a pro before, and I've ridden with quite a few, I get kicked on this every time. I try to hit the hill. I'm pounding on them, showing them how good of a climber I am. I get to the top. I'm exhausted. I hear this click, click, click. And they're rolling me over, and poof, they're gone. They are gone. And no matter how fast I climbed the hill, it didn't matter. They have enough energy left because they've been sagging me the whole time. And poof, they disappear. So for people that are listening, you need to learn to let go that you may not always be the first to the top. But if you're in the front group to the top, or even there at the last position coming up, and you have the most energy as you crest over, you're going to see consistent improvement in your climbing moving forward. And a lot of everyday cyclists just don't have the discipline to try that because they're afraid. They're saying, well, you know, I used to be at the front, now I'm towards the middle, but man, I get to the top and I got all this energy left over that no one else has got, and I'm just killing them in the next section or on the downhill.
And that sort of goes into the next question we had. It's an interesting one because I've been in this situation before. Our listener says, when I ride a century, I get intimidated by other cyclists who climb faster or stronger than I do. As a result, I try to chase them down or keep their pace. This eventually leads to me blowing up before the summit. Do you have any advice? And for me, I call this, you know, the greyhound and the rabbit syndrome. That guy goes by you and you're like, I got to chase down that rabbit.
Right.
In a situation like that, where somebody's going by that much faster, is that a situation for, as you said, this sag climbing? Or is it one where you've got to mentally say to yourself, look, you know, I've got to keep my pace. I've got to keep with my training.
Sag climbing only works if you can basically ride your tempo and still stay with the group. Sag climbing becomes basically a disconnect once that lead group or other rider is basically just, you know, maybe leaps and bounds ahead of you in fitness, which is okay. Again, what happens is if you do it's natural instinct for any cyclist of any level to want to chase someone down, especially if they're riding on a weekend group ride or whatever it is. And typically what people will tend to do is they'll dip into their energy reserves, into their red line, if you will, for too long just to try to chase them down. And as a result, once most of us chase someone down and have to go way down into our resources, the other person has barely even touched theirs.
Yeah.
So you get the top. Even if you've caught them, unless the ride finishes at the top of that hill, you still got a ways to go. You're going to suffer the rest of the ride. So you're actually better off conserving your energy, riding your tempo, staying just at your line, if not slightly below, get to the top, and have more consistent energy. And that consistent energy is going to give you a better overall ride. And then again, I can't say enough, you have to go into your training during the week and practice. So a lot of people that will say things like that, they'll do too much group riding. And they'll feel like that all the time. They're constantly off the back. And then they ask themselves, well, how come I'm never improving? Well, because you're always trying to chase someone down. And like, oh, well, you need to get away from that. Solo yourself a little bit. Work on some of the techniques we can give you. So when you come back to your favorite rides, you've got some assets, because I got to tell you, just chasing someone down is not really building many assets. It's constantly throttling you to your red line, and you're not able to address the problems.
Yeah, it's a good tip. Cycling is such a social sport that you think, oh, I want to go out with my buddies all the time. But you're right. Sometimes it's better. Go out and train by yourself so that when you get back together with your group or your club, you're in that much better shape. It's a great point.
Right.
Well, let me ask you another question. You know, there's a ride out here. I talked about it the other day on the show, Logan to Jackson or Low to Jack. And it's about a 206-mile ride, and it goes through some high-altitude climbs. I got a question from a listener who said, look, I'm a flatlander. I don't live someplace where there are high-altitude climbs. How do I train for something like that?
I'm glad you brought that question up, David. I've done consults for Lodija and many others just like it. I myself am actually getting ready for the Death Ride in July, which is, what, 15,000 feet. You know, it's probably the hardest, you know, single climbing day event that I've heard of or consulted for. And I live in Connecticut, so I'm on the shoreline right now. I'm at sea level, literally, as we speak. And I just gave a whole bunch of tips and secrets about that exact topic at my other podcast page. Do you mind if I share that?
All right, go ahead. But everybody come back to the Fredcast afterwards.
EverydayCyclistPodcast.com. The second entry, I think, I gave it just a day or two ago. I'll share some of my secrets of what I'm doing at sea level to get ready for altitude training and for altitude, climbing fitness. But I'll have some more tips coming up about that. I get this time of year, I get a lot of those questions. Graham, I've got this event coming up in the mountains or that event coming up in the mountains. I'm a flatlander. What do I do? So besides just the training and nutrition, I have some other tricks up my sleeve that we'll be sharing here in the future at the podcast page.
Okay, I'll put a link in the show notes for that. Hey, Graham, I've got a bunch of other questions. Can I ask? Can you come back next week and answer some more of these questions for us?
I'd love to. Absolutely.
That would be great. Graham, thanks once again for being on the Fredcast.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
A lot of good info there from Graham. Stay tuned for next week's part two of the interview on climbing. More of your questions. Graham and I are going to be doing this on a fairly regular basis, and we're going to be adding other topics in the future. So follow the Twitter feed and get your questions in the next time we are looking for questions for the podcast. Well, that is going to do it for this week's episode of the Fredcast. Once again, I do want to thank Graham Street and Cyclo Club for sponsoring the Fredcast. Don't forget, they are giving away a free download of Cyclo Back in 5. Work on that core. Work on those low back problems. Go to www.thefredcast.com right away and download that, because it is only available for a limited time. Thanks so much to Cyclo Club for sponsoring the show. Also, quick reminder, don't forget, sign up for our Chasseur de Col, our trip in September to the French Alps. You can go to vivatravels.com for that. And one more thing. I want to thank those of you who donate to the Fredcast on PayPal and those of you who subscribe with your PayPal donations every single month. Every little bit helps. The podcast does take a lot of time and a little bit of money as well, and we appreciate your support in any way possible. Just go to www.thefredcast.com. You'll find all of that information there, as well as all of the information about the Fredcast. Don't forget, you can send me an email anytime. The email address is thefredcast@gmail.com. And of course, you can send us a voicemail, area code 435-258-6373. And of course, to follow along on what's going on every moment of every day, the best way for that is to follow our Twitter feed. And that's twitter.com/Fredcast. And finally, as we do every week, it's time for our PodSafe cycling music. Tonight's music comes to us from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This one's kind of exciting because I always love it when we can get artists that you are already familiar with. This is somebody I know that you are familiar with. This is the godfather of soul himself, none other than James Brown. This is his song, Gut Bucket. So for those of you who are worried about climbing and worried about your gut bucket, here's James Brown to rock you through your next climb. Between the next show and your next climb and tonight, I hope that you enjoy the music, but most of all, enjoy the ride. Hey, y'all.
but it's a body thriller. You can't hold it. Good God, but your body can mold it. Hey, 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 hey! Got the in the pocket. Oh, yes, sir. If you please, you got something to squeeze. Take it there. With no heart beating. Oh, you my mean squeeze. Hey, hey. Kids, me.